todo el mundo.
But this was really
1981.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson, author of the Rock and Roll Nightmares book series and director of the documentary The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. This is your destination for all things rock, where the interviewees include musicians, authors, historians, filmmakers, and more. And now, on to the show. My guest today is a longtime friend and colleague of mine, Scott Hoover. Scott has written an incredibly well-researched, super immersive true crime book, Beverly Hills Noir, Crime, Sin, and Scandal in 90210, which I got an early peek at and I absolutely loved it. Scott is a former Beverly Hills newspaper reporter and longtime entertainment journalist, and with this book, he takes readers on a century-long jaunt through some of the city's most notorious events, including a couple that are rock and roll adjacent. So let's get him on the line to find out more. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, glad to be here.
Well, I read your book, Beverly Hills Noir, and I know it's been percolating for some time, and now it's about to be released, which is super exciting. But I'm wondering, like, how'd you get the initial idea for it? And is it your first book?
It's my first book on my own. I did a book about 20 years ago about Rodeo Drive with a co-author. We had been publishing a magazine about the street for the stores on the street, kind of their own little mini chamber of commerce. Mm-hmm. So I did that one. And I've ghost written a couple of books for an artist and a few other things, but this is my first all mine book. So, you know, my first job in Los Angeles when I moved here 30 years ago was at a newspaper in Beverly Hills. And one of my beats was police and crime, and I also wrote a lot of local history, and so the kind of convergence of those two, I started realizing how many really incredible, bizarre, only in 90210 kind of crimes had happened over the history of the city. And my initial thought was I wanted to do something like a history of the police department. You know, I thought I'd do something for their union, or, you know, mm-hmm. And then the more I thought about it, I'm like, this feels like kind of a big commercial thing. And I eventually left that job and did other things and segued into being an entertainment journalist. And I always just kind of kept up as a hobby, looking into more details about the stories I knew, looking for new stories. And it just kind of had been percolating for a really long time. And finally, during the pandemic, I had time to sit down, figure out what I wanted to do, pick the stories for at least the first volume, because there's a lot to choose from. And I, you know, was able to put together a book proposal and relatively quickly get a deal and move forward. And I had also, as a sort of exercise, I'd written two or three chapters just to do it, you know. Over a period of years. So I kind of did have like some groundwork laid. I did end up like expanding anything I'd already written by a considerable amount when I finally got
that's such a detailed book.
That was really fun. Like, you know, just taking these things and looking at them, because I could have done a full book of, like, you know, there's so many stories, and I could have done a couple paragraphs or, you know, a couple pages on every story I knew about. Mm-hmm. But I really wanted to marinate in the details, tell these in sort of the same way that, like, Vanity Fair tells stories, or the way that Dominic Dunn would do these long essays on true crime. And I ended up writing really two books worth of stories. So I'll keep my fingers crossed that this one sells and I'll be able to do the second one, because it's already written.
Yeah, you're already that much further ahead. Well, how did you get into entertainment reporting? I guess just kind of being a reporter and living in the entertainment capital of the world might have been part of it, but what else drew you to that profession?
It was definitely where my interests lie. You know, even at the newspaper, working at, like, a local newspaper, it's a local newspaper in Beverly Hills, which is so tied to the industry. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a chapter in the book that I write about just what it was like in the mid 90s when I was working there. You know, celebrities were still very part of the everyday infrastructure of Beverly Hills. You would go to a school board meeting and, you know, Valerie Harper would stand up with an issue she wanted to raise, or you'd go to a city council meeting and Jack Lemmon would be there with a complaint about something his neighbor was doing that violated an ordinance, you know.
Wow.
And so it was in all these, you know, the agencies were all headquartered in Beverly Hills, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences was there. So it was definitely like I got a little experience from that. And again, working with the Rodeo Drive stores right after, that was another, you know, very entertainment adjacent kind of field. And so I had been writing my first book and doing some screenplays and all kinds of different stuff. And I had a deal going right about the time the book came out. I had a deal that was about to happen. And then that all fell apart, as things do in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
Book came out and I had spent so much time between those two things that I said, you know, I've got to make sure I've got a stable career.
Yeah.
And so by sheer chance, somebody that I knew in college, but wasn't, like, really tight with, had seen a job posting and forwarded it to a mutual friend and said, this sounds like something Scott should be doing. And my friend sent it to me and I said, you know, that's true. It is. And so I went after that job and got it. It was at Hollywood.com, which was at the time one of the kind of vanguard of entertainment sites on the internet, that had real genuine access to movie junkets and premieres and interviews and that. So that was, you know, my first step in. And from that, I've sort of networked my way to today. I'm a freelance journalist and I've written, you know, I write with people. People's been my client for almost 20 years now. I've written for TV Guide, In Style, Vulture, CNN, you name it. I feel like I've done something for them.
Yeah.
And so that really gave me, that filled in my knowledge, you know, of what I'd learned about Beverly Hills in particular. That kind of gave me a more holistic view of the entertainment industry and the LA, you know, the broader culture of LA throughout time. And so that all of that was extremely helpful in putting this book together.
Yeah, the book feels like kind of a like a hard-boiled crime, but also a love letter to movies and movie stars. And you have covered quite a few in the book. Now that most of the chapters cover sort of old school crimes and stars. So let's go into the rock stars of their day, Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr. How did their antics and their careers kind of set the stage for the famous musicians to come?
You know, they both have these really interesting trajectories that I think really the template still applies today. Is, you know, they in their earliest days, they rose quite quickly to become phenomenons and phenomenons with a rabid following. Like it was known in, you know, in the 40s for the Bobby Soxers, which was, you know, a precursor to Beatlemania, which, you know, keep it going and you end up with, you know, Beliebers or Swifties. This really intensely loyal fan base that is going to continue on with the artist as long as they continue to evolve. And the same can be said with Dean Martin, especially starting out with Jerry Lewis as a comedy team. You know, they were as big as Bing Crosby or Frank in their heydays, as big as Elvis. They attracted crowds outside the hotel rooms where they were staying. And, you know, Dean really, following in the heels of Crosby and Sinatra, made a career in a lot of different fields between recording, movies, and then television. He was the highest paid at the time of the story is set in my book. He was the highest paid entertainer in show business, more than Sinatra.
Really?
Yeah. And they also came with, you know, they brought a little color and scandal.
Yes, indeed.
Along with great artistry. And, you know, with Frank was known for, you know, his temperament. He was known for all of these alleged, you know, gangster ties. He was known for fiery romances with, you know, fellow movie stars. Dean had a more stable kind of personal life, but it was professional life got really stormy when he broke up with Jerry Lewis, which was a huge, huge thing. I can't think of anything equivalent today. What kind of breakup would be equivalent to that?
I don't know. Jane's addiction.
Yeah, maybe. So, you know, so they were larger than life figures by the time they hit their 50s, and, you know, were still hugely popular. I mean, right before this incident took place, just a couple of years before, Dean made a bet with his son, who was a big fan of the Beatles, that he jokingly said he'd make a record and knock him off the charts, and he actually did.
Wow. Yeah, and then I think of the, you know, the satanic panic of the 80s with the heavy metal bands, but a lot of people probably don't know that Sammy Davis Jr., I guess just for a short while, joined the Church of Satan in the 70s. So they all kind of, it all comes full circle, right?
Yeah, Sammy was, he was an interesting case. He was a seeker, and he was about 10 years younger than Frank and Dean. And even though he was in their category of music, he was a little bit more of a contemporary of the emerging rock and roll scene. And so he was a little bit more adventurous and attracted to different kinds of danger than old Blue Eyes. And he's got a lot of stories. I'll find, hopefully for a future volume, I'll find myself a good Sammy Davis Jr. story to tell, because I haven't quite found it yet.
Yeah, I have his autobiography and I haven't read it yet, but I'm excited to dive into it at some point. Although I understand that his publisher told him to cut out that chapter about Anton LaVey.
look on eBay for an older version.
I will for sure. So Hotel California, one of my favorite Eagles songs, and the album is so iconic. And that is in Beverly Hills. I always kind of thought it looked kind of beachy. But can you tell me about how that photo came about for that album cover?
Yeah, the hotel in that photo, that sort of legendary album cover, is the Beverly Hills Hotel. Mm-hmm. And an interesting thing about the hotel is that it actually predates the city of Beverly Hills. Back in the early 1910s, there was a group of investors that had bought all this property. It used to be like a Mexican ranchero, full of bean fields and cattle. And it was purchased with the idea that there was a good likelihood there was oil underneath. And the landowners searched for oil, didn't find oil, but they found plenty of natural water underneath the territory. And so that's why it was so lush and green. And it was sort of ideally situated halfway between downtown, where the city was really being, you know, built up, and the Pacific Ocean, where there was the resort feel starting to emerge. So the landowners decided, let's build a hotel that has like all of the greatest luxury touches and use this as a place, as a sleepover place, as people are on their way to the beach, and hopefully they'll fall in love with the territory and buy our property. And they hired Margaret Anderson, who ran the Hollywood Hotel, which was similarly luxurious in the heart of Hollywood, where the Ovation, the former Hollywood and Highland, and
oh,
the
yeah.
Kodak, the Dolby Theater, where they have the Academy Awards every year now. That's where the Hollywood Hotel was. So they hired the woman who owned and ran that to create this hotel. And the plan actually worked. And people were coming and just falling for Beverly Hills and buying property left and right. And it was at a time when Hollywood was falling out of favor because of its own scandalous reputation. And the big star that kind of led the charge was Douglas Fairbanks, who bought property, like a quiet little hunting lodge property, which he used sort of very low key in his relationship with America's sweetheart, Mary Pickford. And then they got married and built Pickfair. And they were sort of a big lure for the industry to move to Beverly Hills. And so almost from the beginning, when the city actually kind of was finally founded in 1914, it was a home of wealthy and famous people. And the Beverly Hills Hotel was always the beating heart of that community. And so even though, as you say, that photo has a very beachy vibe, it's, you know, it's still about 15 minutes away from the beach, but it's got that great, you know, Spanish colonial architecture, that beautiful, distinctive pink hue that the hotel has.
Yeah, it's very alluring for sure.
Even that photograph was controversial, because once the hotel found out that that was them on the Eagles cover, they actually, you know, started legal proceedings because they didn't give any permission for that to be the case. But
oh, wow.
Nothing ultimately on record ever came of that. So I assume it was settled. But yeah, that became, you know, the hotel became the place where, because they have these bungalows behind, a lot of moguls, movie stars used it as a getaway, because it was so far from prying eyes, but so easy to get to everything in LA to do business. So Marilyn Monroe spent a lot of time living in the bungalows when she was making movies. Orson Welles lived there quite often. Howard Hughes lived there for quite a while when he was in his, you know, paranoid beginning of dementia kind of phase, to the degree that he didn't want anybody to know when he ate his meals. So the room service had to bring the food out to his bungalow, and it was usually just like a peanut butter sandwich, and hide it in a tree.
Oh my gosh, really?
Someone out to get it so nobody would know. And
that's
he parked
wild.
A car on, he parked a car on the side street, on Crescent, and left it there for years, and the police just knew to look the other way, and it would, you know, they didn't need to ticket it. Hughes would take care of it. And it stayed there so long that there were weeds growing out of the tires.
Jeez. Yeah, that's, it has quite a storied history. Is there any other kind of interesting mythology surrounding that? Has it been used as locations in movies, or is it haunted, or what else can you tell me about the Beverly Hills Hotel?
I don't think I've ever heard any real credible haunting stories. It's definitely, you know, been the scene of a few movies. I think the probably the most prominent would be Designing Woman, with Lauren Bacall, which was shot at the pool. But they, in the years since I've been here, it has been, I don't know. I don't think the hotel kind of like doesn't encourage shooting there. It's never been a popular site. You don't see it show up in movies and TV very often, unlike, say, the Beverly Wilshire, which is at the heart of this, of Beverly Hills by Rodeo Drive, or some of the other hotels. Like, so I think it's probably a conscious decision for the privacy of the guests, because it's so elite. Even the Polo Lounge, you rarely see any shooting unless it's like promotional, you know, for the hotel and the lounge. But I'm trying to think of the controversies. I mean, I know of some stories back in the day, because it was really not just a hotel when the city started. It was really like, they did church services there. They had schools, classes
really?
There. Yeah, it was very much like a community center. So there were a couple like attempted robberies. Probably the biggest thing was directly across the street. The hotel sits right on Sunset Boulevard. And directly across the street, there's a park called Will Rogers Park.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the park in which George Michael was arrested for soliciting sex from an undercover police officer in the men's room of the park.
Whoops. I remember when that happened.
Yeah,
that was all over the news. Yeah.
That was 1998. And that kind of pushed him out of the closet. He was not openly gay. He was known amongst his friends and family, but had not gone public with it. And that kind of pushed him out. And he actually very successfully handled that as a scandal. The 90s were big on celebrity scandals, as you'll remember.
Yeah.
Beginning with OJ, but things like Hugh Grant, and it seemed like there was something new every other week.
No kidding. And the Menendez brothers, of course, yep, from Beverly
Mighty
Hills.
Fleiss, and so George very, very nimbly and cleverly used his sense of humor. He owned what he did. He did kind of fight back and insisted that he had been entrapped, but otherwise he owned what he did and went, did the talk show circuit and was very amusing about it. Faced it head on, did his charity work as a result of being convicted, and made that, shined a big light on a local charity called Project Angel Food, which is wonderful for them. They still look at him as one of their angels and just dedicated a Walk of Fame style thing outside their headquarters, with a star kind of dedicated to George. So that was probably the biggest thing in recent memory, but there's been some scuffles. I know Anna Nicole Smith got into an issue with the valets, where she got a little overserved at an event.
Yeah.
Got into a scuffle. I think a similar situation happened with Kim Richards from the Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. But nothing too outrageous. It's a very deluxe hotel. It had been closed when I first moved here. It had been closed for a couple of years for remodeling, and it was then and is now owned by the Sultan of Brunei. And that opening party, when they reopened up the hotel, was like every episode of The Love Boat and Fantasy Island and the whole roster of Turner Classic Movies. Every star you could think of that was alive in 1995 was at that party. And they had a tower. I've never seen anything like this. Must have been 15 feet tall, tower of champagne glasses. And they, as far as I know, it was the Sultan, climbed up a ladder and poured champagne out of these huge like magnums. So it trickled down this gigantic tower. It was really something to have been at.
That is very Beverly Hills for sure.
Yeah.
Well, you had told me before when we were talking about your book that you have a whole George Michael chapter, which I think is great. And I hope that there will be a sequel because we need more details. You are so great at finding all these little facts that I don't think are readily available. One of my favorite chapters in the book is about the jewelry heist at Van Cleef & Arpels. And I'd read about it before, but wow, so many details that you brought out, little minutiae about the personalities of the people, not just the crime. So what's your process for finding those kind of facts?
That one in particular, I'll say I started with, being in Beverly Hills, working at the newspaper only a decade after it had originally happened. It took place in the summer of 1986, and by 1996, I was working in Beverly Hills. So a lot of the police officers that were involved that day were still on the force at that time. And I'd done little recaps for the newspaper and talked to people. I'd known the chief of police, pretty well in the course of my job. And he was an interesting character, and he was really, his arrival in Beverly Hills really signaled an evolution, that they weren't, although Beverly Hills always had the best crime fighting tools of the day at their disposal, the force in general became a very world-class professional operation under Chief Iannone. This just happened early on in his tenure, and it's kind of a horrific situation. And I think it probably would, if it were to happen again, it would be handled much differently because of what they learned from this. But it, yeah, so it was, that's where I started, is having a little hands-on already. And then I'm a sucker for research. And in that case, you know, if I see something, I stash it away. If it's a story I see online, I save a link, put it in a file. If it's a magazine, book, I flag everything and kind of have little stacks of where I know I might have future research. And I just try to remember where it is.
Yeah, that's really clever, because a lot of times these websites go out of business and then they're gone. So it's good to have that.
Yeah, even my own writing has vanished. So much of it has vanished from the internet. And I've made, you know, I've been writing for the internet for over 20 years. And because of changes and just simple technological changes, even sites that still exist, they use different content systems, and you can't find stuff you know you wrote or videos you know you shot. Like, they're somewhere.
Yeah. The Beatles had kind of their own crazy Beverly Hills story. And I understand Elvis Presley, the king of rock and roll himself, did too. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, Elvis, for a while was renting a house up in what was at the time brand new area called Truesdale Estates, where a lot of celebrities lived. And rockers traditionally have tend to rent houses there. I know, like, Elton John's lived there, Prince lived there at different times, and Elvis was there. And if you, I haven't been up there in a few years, but it's up until recently, you could still go up to the home that Elvis rented, and you would see, like, carved on the front gate, these "I love you, Elvises" that who knows how many decades they've been sitting there. And then, you know, for years, Elvis would live in a suite at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, right at Wilshire Boulevard and Rodeo Drive. I think most people today know it as, like, the Pretty Woman Hotel.
Yeah.
And, you know, fans would come and, like, try to send notes up to him by balloon, tied to balloon.
That's inventive.
And send it out. So Elvis was, you know, then he lived in over in Holmby Hills for a while. And Elvis was always a big supporter and proponent of law enforcement.
Yes.
And so I was talking to a guy. He was a longtime detective, had been on the force, you know, started as a beat cop. At the time we talked, he had been the longest serving officer in the Beverly Hills Police Force. He was the guy who interrogated the Menendez brothers the night of the murders. He'd been around the block, and he was telling me how he was out one day on patrol in a black and white unit, and he pulled over a car, and he noticed, as he started to get out of his car, that another car, a big Cadillac, had pulled up right behind his police unit. And glanced back, and he looked behind the driver's wheel, and he sees Elvis Presley sitting there. And Elvis just gives him a little nod. And as the cop told me, he said, "I knew then that Elvis was trying to have my back, and I knew that Elvis was packing."
Yeah, Elvis was taking care of business.
Yep. And he said he wrote up the ticket for the guy he pulled over, went back to his car. Elvis nodded again, pulled away. No incident. No, didn't have to reveal his weapon. But I just thought that was the funniest story. Like, Elvis was there for the cops when they needed him, if they needed him.
Honorary deputy. I love it. Well, Beverly Hills Noir will be published on October 1st by Post Hill Press, which is distributed by Simon & Schuster. So, way to go, Scott. How can people pre-order the book?
It is pretty much wherever you buy your books from the major booksellers: Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart, Target, and then hopefully, you know, your indies will be carrying it too. But it should be pretty easy to get your hands on.
Fantastic. I think everyone should read it. And if they're in LA, I know that you're doing a signing at Book Soup. So, what can you tell me about your signing schedule, your author tour, and where can fans find and follow you and the book on social media?
Yeah, I'll be doing a signing and a Q&A at Book Soup in West Hollywood on October 4th, a few couple days after the book comes out at 7 p.m. And that should be a fun night. That's going to be my first sort of like big book event. I'm really looking forward to it. Book Soup's a great bookstore as well.
They are, yeah.
And right in the heart of it, right next door, there is, other than a Tashin, there is no proper bookstore in Beverly Hills, and there really rarely is. I found that
So
out.
everyone's reading their greenbacks, I guess, instead of their paperbacks there.
Yeah, there was famously a bookstore called Hunter's on Rodeo Drive up until Rodeo Drive took off as a, you know, extravagant shopping street, and
Yeah.
that's when people lost interest in books on Rodeo Drive, apparently. But yeah, so and then I'm hoping I spent most of my summer away, so I'm a little behind on booking stuff, but I should be having some more signings in the LA area.
Okay, well, how can we find out about those signings as they come up? Is there a website or a social media
Yeah.
landing place?
Definitely, I'd say the best place, the most up-to-date place will be at the Instagram page for the book, and that's Beverly Hills under Beverly underscore Hills underscore Noir. And then also my own Instagram page is a good place to look, and that's at the Hoove, THEHUVE on Instagram.
Well, I'm a follower of both, and I love the content that you're putting out there. And congratulations on the book, which I think is great timing because it's not only a book that everyone will want to read for themselves, but it's also a good holiday gift. So your timing is right on.
Yeah, and I think hopefully Ryan Murphy did me a favor by putting out the Menendez Brothers series.
Exactly. It's all
Because that one was
perfect.
too big for me to get my arms around for this book. But if people are interested in Beverly Hills crime, these are the stories you have not heard about.
Yes, that's what I love about it. Well, thank you, Scott. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Stacey. This was fun.
This concludes another episode of the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Remember, there's a book series too. All the books are available in paperback, ebook, and audio via Amazon or the Rock and Roll Nightmares website. That's ROCK-N-ROLL-Nightmares.com. Our official theme song is She's Out for Blood by Fuzzbuster, founded by Lars Cabot. Thank you for listening.